Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Ariana Malloy on pursuing a sustainable calling.
A custodial staff member at a hospital that I interviewed felt like it was her job, her calling, to make that room clean for the next person that was going to come in with trauma. You know, an artist felt like it was their calling to illuminate someone else's understanding of beauty. A football coach that I interviewed felt like it was his calling to not only cultivate really good players, but good men. So that's meaningful work. Second is that you can identify a sense of caller. So there's a real clear sense of something. And as a Christian, I had believed that to be God.
Ariana Malloy, next. Biola University professor Dr. Ariana Malloy wants believers to joyfully pursue our callings while managing our risk for burnout. As you'll hear in today's discussion with Spencer Dahlke, she says humility is essential to a healthy calling. Dr. Ariana Malloy's new book is Healthy Calling, From Toxic Burnout to Sustainable Work.
The first question I have for you is, what prompted you to write the book?
Yeah, really good question. I mean, in many ways, that's a multi-layered answer. On the one hand, I've always wanted to write a book about meaningful work, calling, and burnout. I think from an early age, I've been fascinated by work. And then in my master's and PhD, studying the different elements, that was fascinating. You know, initially, the research that I did was on the bright side of calling. So studying all the cool things, like how it makes you the most motivated, the most satisfied. You have greater resilience than any other peer group in the workplace. So more than people who pursue it as a career or just a job, if you feel called to your work, you're the person they want in the room. Like, you're the person they call after hours and you're like, yes, I can. But as I began to do more and more research, I also saw that more than any other people group, those who feel called are the most prone to burnout. And I just thought, how can that be? And so I did some scholarly articles I've written in the academic circles, but I kept thinking, we need to talk about this at large. Like, we need to be talking about this at our dinner tables and when we go for walks and in church and in organizations. And so I had the opportunity, someone actually contacted me to write this book. And you know what, Spencer, at first I said no, because I was like on the cusp of burnout in my own life at that moment. But I prayed about it and I really felt like now was the time. And ultimately, because if you feel called to the work you do, it's not a question of if you get burnt out, it's when. And so how do you be proactive about that?
We think of work as kind of one thing, like you go to work in the morning, things like that. But you say it's actually three things. Would you care to outline those for us?
So when I'm talking about work, it's not just paid work that we're talking about. We're talking about any kind of intentional endeavor or focused attention you give something on a regular basis that requires your mental, emotional, and or physical dedication. And the thing that's crazy about that is it could be anything. It's very subjective. And so, you know, what one person finds to be meaningful work, another person would be like, no way, this is not what I want to do. So someone feels very excited about event planning. Another person's like, nope, that is not my jam, you know? And so, when we're talking about work, I think it's important to recognize this includes students in the work they do as a student. This includes caregivers and parents. This includes startup organizations. This includes internships, CEOs, artists, athletes, performers. So work in a larger level. Now there's three different ways you can approach work. You can approach it like just a job, and that is just to pay the bills. And that is real. That's a privilege to pay the bills. But in this approach to work, you don't necessarily use your skill sets that much, or it's not totally directly aligned with your passion. And there may not be like a promise of moving forward. It's you're literally living for the weekend. You're doing your job to pay the bills, live for the weekend. And then the second approach to work is a career. In this way, you will use your skill sets and passions, and you do feel that external motivation when you see external rewards. So, new paycheck. You get to pay off your student loans. You can buy a car. You can take your family on vacation. You have a corner office. These are markers of a successful career. When you approach work as a calling, it really is something a bit different. It's often intangible. So you may not see the outcome of the work you're doing, but when you do it, it feels like a sweet spot. And there's four different ways that when we're experiencing work as a calling, this happens. The first is that it's meaningful, like we just talked about. And again, like this could be, you know, you're flipping the switch on and off, but For some people, that's meaningful. For others, it's not. A custodial staff member at a hospital that I interviewed felt like it was her job, her calling, to make that room clean for the next person that was going to come in with trauma. You know, an artist felt like it was their calling to illuminate someone else's understanding of beauty. A football coach that I interviewed felt like it was his calling to not only cultivate really good players, but good men. So that's meaningful work. Second is that you can identify a sense of caller. So there's a real clear sense of something, and as a Christian, I believe that to be God, someone is calling me. But even non-Christians identify that sense of calling, of a caller. The third part is you do absolutely make use of your skill set and your passion. Now, this is not like you have to have all these things that you were born with in your skills. They need to be developed, but it's skill set and passion. And then the last is that it involves making a positive contribution to others. So this is what makes it different than a hobby. A hobby is just for yourself, but calling in work in the workplace is pro-social. It's what social scientists call pro-social behavior.
How does one identify his calling? Like, how do we identify that?
I really wish I could give you like this easy answer that'd be like, okay, here's how we figure it out. The thing that's really important, and in fact, if we were going to take away anything from our time together today, this is the thing I would want us to land on. Calling is about relationship. We often get distracted with the pursuit of our calling. We should be fully focused on the pursuit of our caller. And the more that we seek to get to know him and ourselves and the community that we're a part of, the more we're able to get a sense of where the Lord is calling us. So calling is about relationship. It's a relational interaction, intrapersonal communication. So it would be kind of like, Spencer, if you woke up and you were like, oh, I get to go to work today. That's you talking to yourself, you know? Or that was a really cool experience that I had at work today. That's like, or the opposite would be like, I hate this so much. You know, and that would be intrapersonal communication, communication with yourself. There's also communication with the caller and how we spend time with God or the one that we identify as a caller, how we listen for his voice, how we pay attention to the way he's speaking to us through the Holy Spirit, through his word, through his church. The third part is community. And this is one we tend to ignore, but the reality is it's not just about ourselves or God. It's also about the community that we impact and also that the community that impacts us. So how do you figure out your calling? It's not a five-step process, but part of it is paying attention to the things that you deeply enjoy and that you're good at or are becoming good at, looking at how that impacts other people for the good, and then thinking through how that might align with what you feel the Lord is doing in your life. I would also suggest that finding a personal board of advisors is really key. So, you know, this is something I often tell my college students is think of 3 to 5 people who you really admire, and then think about what do you admire about them and how could you on a routine basis go to, you know, one a week or at least one a month and check in with them and say, hey, what are you noticing that I tend to be good at or what's an area that you think I need to grow in and get their advice. And I'll even tell you sometimes for me in my life, it was like people that I didn't even know, like C.S. Lewis was on my personal board of advisors for a while. I would read his books and be like, okay, C.S. Lewis, what are you telling me to do? But a lot of times it was other mentors and they would speak into my life. But again, calling is about relationship, which means it's a process. We don't realize where the Lord is leading us until we look back and reflect on it.
I noticed in a lot of places you describe calling almost as something individualistic. You've mentioned it as a relationship, but also just the sense of if there is something that you want to do, like go do it.
Yeah, you know, actually, that's really only half the picture. So the reality is that, you know, we have our primary calling, which is loving God and loving others well, but that also doesn't acknowledge necessarily his specific artistic nature in us. And so, yes, in that regard, it is about ourselves, like understanding ourselves individually, but actually calling is totally community-based and collective. And so we have to pay attention to the body of Christ. We have to pay attention to our role in that. And it really isn't just about ourselves at all.
In a lot of ways, like even in my own life, my friends have helped me understand like, well, what do I enjoy? What do I like to do? So
yeah, totally. And I mean, I have an entire chapter in my book about how that third C of community is ignored and that we actually in Western society tend to only focus on ourselves or maybe ourselves and the caller. But in reality, calling is about 3 different types of relationships. And that third C of community is essential.
Well, your book is, of course, about burnout. So we've talked a little bit about calling. Do you care to define for us what you mean by toxic burnout?
Sure, absolutely. And this is really important because, you know, burnout gets a lot of attention these days, right? And as it should, frankly, we're not talking about it enough in some ways. I know sometimes people are like, I'm burnt out with talking about burnout, but it's only because it's like, how do we get out of it? So typical burnout can involve all sorts of really awful things, you know, psychological paralysis, feelings of depression and anxiety. There's a lack of energy. You just can't force yourself to get out of bed or get out of your car. You doom scroll rather than connect with other people. It can have increased sick days and ultimately lead to a dark place of feeling like, I do not like what I'm doing anymore. It is meaningless. That's regular burnout. But burnout from a calling is that and more. It has to do with that feeling of deep shame that what you used to feel God was leading you to do, you felt like a holy responsibility you can't do or you don't want to do anymore. And knowing that you can positively impact this community, but you don't have it in you anymore, that lends itself to a greater sense of toxic burnout that it's more like, instead of I don't like what I'm doing, it's I don't know who I am anymore. Because again, calling is about relationship. And when we were burnt out from that, it affects the core part of our identity.
It struck me when you identified shame as a key aspect of burnout. I wouldn't have thought to identify shame as it playing a part in our careers and callings and whatnot. Why do you think it's shame?
I mean, like we just talked about, the reality is that when you feel a holy obligation, when you feel this like, I meant to do this, or I can do this, I can make a difference, but you don't have it in you anymore. You don't want to, or you don't have the capacity to. There's a sense of overcoming. Psychologists and social scientists call it deep shame. It has to do with confusing living out your calling and relationship with your caller, with your calling being the ultimate goal. So this is where we confuse calling with the caller. And when we feel like we're not able to do it anymore, we get off track and we can begin to think that our value and our capacity and our possibility is gone, when in fact, that's not true at all. You know, what I was thinking about recently is I love that God is the kind of Heavenly Father that pursues us even when we have gone the opposite way. He seeks us out in the garden. He watches for us when we've gone astray. He meets us on the beach with food after we've denied him 3 times. He comes into the storm and walks on water to get us out of the boat. And when our eyes drift from him, he reaches down and grabs us. He pursues us. And in our calling, the deep shame lies to us and says, we won't be able to do this ever again. And the Holy Spirit, our caller, says, that's just not true.
I guess burnout can manifest itself in many different ways. How else could it manifest itself? How can we identify it?
Yeah, I mean, some really good signs of burnout is that you've lost your motivation to do the thing you used to love to do. It's sort of like if you've ever had food poisoning, and unfortunately, if you have food poisoning from your favorite thing, like I had food poisoning when I was in grad school after eating sushi and mint chocolate chip ice cream. And it just took me so long to even be able to imagine the food, let alone eat it again, right? And when you're in a place of burnout, I think it feels like there is no hope. According to the data, it feels like there is no hope, that survival mode is normal, that chronic stress is the way your life is going to look now, and that there is no way out. You are stuck in a deep, dark pit. But again, shame is a liar, and we cannot listen to it.
You mentioned chronic stress just then. I know you have like a whole chapter that talks about chronic stress and what you call the deadly duo of workaholism and job idolization. Care to share what those are and how those can creep into our lives?
Sure. And I like your question about like, what does burnout actually look like and how do we watch for it? Because this needs to be very practical. And I remember talking to someone of like, how do I know I'm not just tired? You know, how do I know it's like burnout versus exhaustion? And that's a really important question. So before we talk about that deadly duo, let's back up and talk about the difference between regular stress and chronic stress, right? Regular stress is unfortunately part of the gravitational pull of this broken world. You know, we have stress when it comes to finals, getting married, redoing your kitchen, a death in the family, a new campaign, a new ministry series, whatever it is, a new project, that all will involve a certain amount of stress that pushes us to get it done. But regular stress is always tied to an end date. When this thing is over, then this will no longer be the case. But chronic stress is when we get so used to survival mode that that way of living seems normal. And in fact, we're a little uncomfortable when we're not feeling stressed like that. And so it can increase our sense of cynicism. We can be cynical. We can be lacking in patience towards others and ourselves. We assume the worst in people rather than the best. So that's all like, you know, the chronic stress is the genesis of burnout. We could even talk more about that. And then in calling, when we feel called to our work, leading us to toxic burnout. Now, we don't have control over everything, Spencer. I wish we did. I wish I had control over all of my life situations so that when hard things in life happen, they don't impact me, but they do. And we don't always have control if we have to work multiple jobs. We don't have control if we have a challenging boss or challenging office mates, whatever that may be, or we have tech issues on a day, right? We don't have control over that. But we do have control over at least two things. And one is workaholism and the other is job idolization. And workaholism is an addiction to work. And what that means is there's a compulsion to do the work to avoid the bad feelings that we can get when we stop doing it. You can imagine like mixing like lake water, you know, in a big glass bowl. And when you're mixing it, you don't really see much. You know, it seems like, you know, regular water. But then when you stop mixing it, all of the yuck and the dirt rises to the top, right? And so in workaholism, if we slow down, then all these bad feelings can come up. And so it's like, no, I got to keep working. I gotta keep doing it. Stay busy, stay full. And so that's an addiction. The difference between workaholism and job idolization is that job idolization is when work has the greatest priority in your life. And so you make every other decision based on your work, and work becomes who you are rather than expression of who you are. And that can be really, really dangerous as well.
I'm not the only one that has observed this. You know, we're very addicted to work. Do you have thoughts about why that is?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, that's a whole like semester class, right? That we could talk about. And I think there's elements of how we view work and our identity attached to work. But at the end of the day, part of it is recognizing how we can cultivate boundaries in our workplace. And, you know, I'm not like anti-technology, but the problem with technology is that we are now accessible and available at all times of the day, at any time. And so it's much harder to do. I think there are value systems in other parts of the world that value family differently, that value life outside of work differently. But in Western culture, especially in the United States, we tend to really attach our worth to the work that we do. And unfortunately, it's very deeply rooted. But this is why taking breaks, taking a Sabbath, attaching our work to a larger picture of things is really important.
You mentioned the three C's in one of your chapters, and that was about connecting. I didn't look too much into the chapter, but if I'm not mistaken, it was something about connecting our calling to our community, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So as we talked about earlier, the three C's in calling are about the one who is called, that's us, the caller, who is God, and the community that we serve and that we impact and also that impacts us. And so paying attention to all three is really important. So here would be a good thing to think about. For the next 3 weeks, for each week, think about one of those C's. So for the first week, maybe you think, okay, how is my relationship with the caller going? Every day, wake up and think, am I spending enough time with God? Is it the right kind of time? Like, is it the kind of time that actually feeds my soul? Where would I place my relationship with God? If you were to think of healthy calling as a spectrum where one side is healthy and the other side is like toxic burnout, where would you place your relationship with God on that spectrum? So just like high focus on that for a week. The next week, it's not that you don't think about that, but what if for an entire week you thought, how am I doing with myself? You know, that the sense of the called. When I'm talking to myself, what are the things I'm saying? Am I honoring myself? Am I like procrastinating at night by, you know, watching too much TV rather than like going to bed? Am I eating well? Am I working out? Am I doing things that actually are going to make me feel good? Or am I allowing myself to kind of have job creep and life creep in a way that doesn't honor who I am, right? That would be paying attention to your sense of your own calling. The third one would be community. And you'd want to ask yourself, How is my community doing? Are there people in my life who are relationally thirsty in a way that I could give to them? Or even thinking about people in your life who are, you know, possibly detracting from that. You know, are you spending too much time with people that it has moved from venting to complaining and it's no longer productive to be a part of those conversations? So again, those three C's make up the relational dynamics of the calling process, ultimately, which leads us to knowing God better and being the hands and feet of Jesus to others.
You mentioned kind of like progressing through like your argument, I guess, humility. I'm sort of starting to see like a bit of a connection between like the community there. But another surprising element of burnout and stuff is humility. Why humility?
So, yeah, what you're talking about is what the exciting surprise in the book is that the way to a healthy calling actually involves prioritizing humility. Now, here's the deal, Spencer. This was not something that I came up with, okay? I was doing research. I had a fellowship for a semester, so about 16 weeks. I taught for half of the load that I normally teach at Biola University, and I got to be with other scholars from all over the country to study the virtue of humility. And why did I sign up for this? I signed up for this because I was getting tired and I could feel that sense of burnout creeping up. So I thought, okay, I need to like alter some things. I'm going to apply for this fellowship. I didn't even really know what I was applying for. Like I didn't really pay attention to the fact that it was for humility. I just like, yes, sign me up. And then when I started studying, and scholars don't necessarily agree on one definition of humility, so that's interesting, but generally there are some main components. But when I started studying what humility looks like in practice, I went back to the data of the research that I'd done in studying people who had a healthy calling. And I realized that if you were to lay them on top of each other, it was the same blueprint. So to live out a healthy calling means to prioritize humility. We can see this biblically, and we can also see this in social science. There are three parts to humility. So the first part of humility is that you know what your strengths are, and you know what your weaknesses are, and you're not distracted by either one. This is why humility is not the same thing as modesty. A modest person, they might, you know, you might compliment them and they're like, oh, thanks, you know, and they nod their head or they shrug their shoulder, they look down. But if you think about it, a modest person is not always aware of what they're good at, right? They're just trying to deflect attention. And so humility is communication competence. And in the workplace, you don't want to work with someone who doesn't know what they're good at. You're going to spend a lot of time trying to redirect them and help them. And that's a whole problem. So it's knowing what you're good at, but you're not focused on that. It's also knowing what you're not good at, but that doesn't threaten you. It's not like you're not defensive about it. You're like, I need to grow, man. You know, like this is what I need to do. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is that humility involves a lifetime of learning. I think it's so sad that after people graduate college or finish school, they stop reading books. I mean, this is like so sad. We have to be challenged. We have to expand our thinking. This doesn't mean that we change our convictions. It just means that we continue to realize we don't know everything. And in the workplace, that means that we're willing to delegate. We're willing to say, you know what? Maybe I feel like I could do this the best, but I'm still going to let someone else do it. Or maybe someone else has something to offer me that I don't know yet, and we're not defensive about it. So a lifestyle of learning. So you know your strengths, you know your weaknesses, neither one distract you. You are a lifelong learner. And the third thing about humility is you know when to pull away. And this is where Sabbath comes in, that humility involves the ability to say, you know what? I'm not the God of the universe. Things should still keep spinning if I take a break. And in fact, you cannot possibly have clarity about yourself if you don't take time for reflection. And you cannot possibly have time for reflection unless you slow down. So this is where Sabbath enters in.
So moving forward, I mean, from toxic burnout, we talked about humility, we talked about it itself. How do we move forward?
Yeah. Again, I think all of this is a process. There's no silver bullet. I mean, I am still learning, Spencer. I've been doing this research for, you know, almost 15 years. And every week I'm like, why did I say yes to this thing? Or, you know, why am I feeling close to burnout? But here's the good news. You identify it sooner. You prioritize good, healthy boundaries. You learn how to respond to people earlier with, you know, can I think about it? Let me get back to you. Thank you so much for sharing that. Let me get back to you. Just give me about 5 minutes, or I'll come back to you in a day. So how do we get started? I would choose one of those aspects of humility and focus on that for a bit, and then go to the next one and keep returning. You know, one of the things that I love to do, I've been doing it for the last, 5 years, is the day before my family and I Sabbath, I go for a walk really early in the morning. I'm blessed to live close to the water, so I drive down to the water and I go for a 30-minute walk, and I call this my pre-game Sabbath strategy. And I go for a walk for about 30 minutes, just talking to the Lord. And I think about, this is the day before we Sabbath, I think about, how did my week go? Where did I fail? Where did I succeed? What's burdening my heart? And how do I want to apply all these things for the coming week? And I think just giving yourself that time is really important. This is another very small strategy, but Dan Pink talks a lot about this in his book called When. But learning how to take micro breaks throughout the day is so important. And a micro break is moving away from the screen. So if you take 2 10 to 15 minute breaks a day, somewhere in your day, and you can listen to music, you can listen to a podcast, absolutely, or a radio station, but you don't want to have your face against the screen. Getting up and moving, going for a walk is great, but those 2 15-minute breaks a day can totally reorient your entire system. So looking for those small practices, it's not going to be one big thing, and changing course correction, it takes time, but we can do it.
One last question for you. How can our communities, given that it's a relational, our callings are relational, how can our communities support each other when they, when individuals are struggling with burnout?
Yeah, I think that part of it is making sure we don't compare our capacity to someone else's. So rather than calling someone a workaholic as a compliment, let's stop doing that. But we can say, you have a high capacity, or you have a medium capacity, or I kind of have a low capacity for this. And so, but I think what we can do is recognize the person to our left and our right might have a different capacity, and it depends on what it is. And that's okay. So really attending to that. I think, again, as a communication professor, I like to say that communication is like the air that we breathe. We don't notice that it's not working until something bad happens. Another way to think about it is that communication is your pulse check. So what can we do? Pay attention to how our friends and our family and our community are talking. Are they being more cynical than normal? Are they saying things that reveal that they're having a hard time? And if they are, let's ask questions. Let's pause and listen and be present, because community does have a healing ointment to it. We were meant to thrive in community. And what's worse is, actually, we tend to feel very isolated when our community does not reach out to us. And so it's really, really important that we do that.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to today's guest, Biola University Professor Dr. Ariana Molloy, author of Healthy Calling, From Toxic Burnout to Sustainable Work. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's John Ensor calling men to be protectors in marriage and fatherhood.
The rules that do not change are that men have a calling on their lives. And again, whether you're Christian or non-Christian, whether you're a secularist, whether you're a Muslim, whatever you are, by creation, you have an intuitive sense that you should be a provider and protector of women in the appropriate ways defined by that relationship, meaning obviously starting with your own wife and children.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.